It's seldom that a week passes nowadays without an invitation to speak, either at a literary festival or at some local literary society. I do fewer of these engagements than most authors, partly because I'm of an age now when I like to sleep in my own bed, and also because I found that, the large literary festivals apart, many of the smaller societies exist less to promote the written word than to beef up the social life of the organisers. Far too often one ends up in a provincial town at 11:30 at night, having a Chinese meal up a back street somewhere with people you don't know. When I do perform, and it is a performance, as Larkin, who refused, as he put it, to go round pretending to be himself, pointed out, I generally read from some of the stuff I've written, with my diaries the most popular, plenty of jokes, and then I take questions from the audience before finishing up with 5 minutes more reading. I'm not especially articulate, so the question and answer segment might seem likely to expose my shortcomings, except that I've found that over a period of time, the same questions tend to recur. Someone will always ask, for instance, if in the monologues I used to write, I have in mind a particular actor or actress. Do I keep to a daily routine when writing, and would I describe it? Why do I seem to prefer writing for women than men? Do I make notes on conversations that I overhear, and in what circumstances? One slightly ticklish question I do get asked, though, and that is whether I've ever been offered any sort of official decoration. Why have I never figured in the honours list? Flattering though the assumption is that my failure to figure is some kind of omission, to date I've never answered this question directly, saying that, had I had such an offer and seen fit to turn it down, to acknowledge this would hardly be fitting. To have accepted an honour without fuss would seem less self-regarding than to turn it down, then boast about it. What should be plainly stated, though, is that the happiest temperament to have is one that accepts whatever distinction is offered and accepts it graciously and without fuss or a lot of soul-searching. This is the nearest one gets to genuine modesty. Isa Berlin, on whom honours were heaped by the bucketful, never demurred. True, he said that these marks of distinction were undeserved and made light of them, but he took them. But who is to say he was more or less modest than someone who refused because they didn't care to be brought into the official fold? Or, as John Updike puts it, who will measure the self-servingness of self-effacement? Towards the end of 2003, a newspaper got hold of a list of those who had refused honours and published their names both in the paper and on the internet. So, while it did not altogether clear the air, the slightly absurd secrecy that has always surrounded the process was to some extent dissipated, and it became possible to talk about honours less obliquely than in the past. John Snow, having turned down a distinction, did a TV programme about the subject, and there was talk of reform. Whether that will happen remains to be seen, but there is no doubt that nowadays the system is more porous and much more discussed. It's hard to object to the honour system, though, when it gives so much twice-yearly pleasure and is the occasion for such rich hypocrisy among the beneficiaries. Perhaps I'm unfortunate in my friends or in the corrupt metropolitan circles in which I move, but it's seldom I come across someone who has accepted a knighthood and done so with genuine pride and pleasure, still less anyone agreeing that it was well deserved. Nobody ever says this is just what they've always wanted, though it's true that Kingsley Amis justified or at least excused his knighthood by saying that he took it because he knew so many people it would annoy, which seems as good a reason for accepting it as any. No, most of the knights I know are a bit shamefaced about it, disclaiming the title even when they have accepted it. They proffer a variety of excuses, their need to do so suggesting they're uncomfortable with their elevation or uneasy about the system altogether. They are anxious to show that they don't take it seriously, and now they are knights or dames or whatever. Could we please forget all about it? More entertaining, though, are those who are in two minds, and when they do accept, feel the need to offer excuses. Their mothers, for instance. After a lifetime on the left, Eric Hobsbawm excused his acceptance of the CH by saying that it would have given his mother much happiness. Fathers are less often adduced, probably because their beadier altogether, and dead or alive, are less likely to be taken in. But as with mothers, so with wives. A husband will often pass off his own snobbery as the aspirations of his wife. Meeting at a reception at Buckingham Palace, the playwrights John Osborne, Harold Pinter and David Hare are all said to have blamed their attendants on the curiosity of their wives. The wives, with more sense, probably not feeling it necessary to blame anyone at all. Still, men being more decorated than women, wives have some reason to feel aggrieved, and may think, quite rightly, that years of long-suffering loyalty entitle them to a share in the credit for their husband's elevation, and that it is proper, therefore, that a knight's wife should be ennobled too, and be called a lady. That men, even when no less loyal, are not so long-suffering as partners, perhaps explains why a wife appointed a dame throws no corresponding cloak of ennoblement over her husband. Nor, it hardly needs to be said, does a knight's elevation affect a partner if that partner is not a wife, or if that partner is not of the opposite sex. As a convention, honours are nothing if not conventional. Another strategy for acceptance is to take the honour as being bestowed on the institution, if such there be, or the firm to which one belongs, the assumption being that the staff or the employees thereby share in the honour. Oh, yeah, would seem a fair response to that, though it's sometimes more plausible than others. I can imagine the average Maltese being boosted by the George Cross, awarded to the whole island for its record of resistance during the Second World War. But whether a thrill of pride went through the ranks of the RUC when the Queen decorated the constabulary as a whole, I'm less sure. I come back to that question from the audience with which I started, and which I used to have to deflect. Nowadays, since it's no longer a secret and can be looked up on the internet, I can go into the circumstances in more detail, and without seeming to be showing off. I was offered a CBE in the Birthday Honours in 1988 for services to literature. I didn't have much hesitation in declining it, because whatever doubts I may have had about the honour system in general, the government through which the award came was still headed by Mrs. Thatcher, and I didn't want anything from that particular handbag. It's true, though, that I had some regrets about refusing it, because I longed to do it with a joke, but couldn't think of one. There was a gap between the letter arriving and my letter of refusal, and it might have been thought I was agonising over the decision. In fact, I just couldn't come up with a witty way of putting it. Of course, in the unlikely event of the Prime Minister actually seeing my letter, she was even more unlikely to have seen the joke. That was part of the trouble. The list, on which I did not figure, was published on Saturday the 6th of June, which happened also to be the day of Russell Harty's funeral. Russell would never have dreamt of refusing anything, and would have been only too delighted to be singled out by Mrs. Thatcher, or even by General Pinochet. Dead, and therefore knowing all things, he would have been infuriated by my piece of cheek. Having turned down the CBE, I thought that would be the end of honours for me, so I was more surprised to be offered a knighthood in the New Year's honours for 1996. Admittedly, it was quite a thin year, so there may have been some scraping of the barrel, but I felt more ungracious saying no this time, if only because it seemed kind that someone in the Prime Minister's office still thought it worthwhile to persist. Again, though, I was mortified not to be able to get a joke out of this grand refusal. The nearest I got to humour was to think, quite genuinely, that being a knight would be like wearing a suit every day of one's life. This didn't seem quite funny enough, though, so I just said no thank you. Richard Eyre claims that apropos honours, I quoted Virginia Woolf as saying that she had been brought up not to accept gifts from strangers. I've no recollection of this, or of knowing that Virginia Woolf said anything of the sort. It's a bit pert for her, I would have thought. Still, it would have done at a pinch. In my case, though, it would be hypocritical to pretend I do not sometimes wonder about all these refusals and what lies behind them, and also that I do not have occasional regrets. Writing can be a pretty cheerless business, and going through a bad patch I sometimes think it would be a consolation to be a sir. Not that it would help. But it's not much of a regret, and it passes. Why I have this recusatory temperament, though, is quite hard to sort out, but it must in part have to do with my father. He was naturally modest and reluctant to push himself forward, and would never have thought he had anything to push himself forward about. As a child I was something of a show-off, which pained him, so I can see this refusal of honours has to do with atoning for that, and is, in part anyway, an attempt to please my dead parent. It's futile, of course. There is no pleasing the dead, and he would probably think I was making too much of a fuss anyway, and would do better taking them and have done. The greatest honour I've ever been given had nothing to do with the honours list, and thus evaded the strictures of my recusatory temperament and all my misgivings about authority. This was when, in 1993, I was appointed a trustee of the National Gallery. It was entirely unexpected and unlooked for. When I asked, why me, I was told that I represented the man in the street. The position of trustee carries with it one inestimable privilege, namely permission to go round the gallery out of opening hours. To be made free of the nation's pictures, and to be allowed to roam the gallery at will, seems to me a distinction of more substance and worth than any of those doled out in the honours list, particularly since, though a trustee serves for 5 or 7 years, the privilege of out-of-hours entry is given for life. Even though I was, for all sorts of reasons, an indifferent trustee, nothing I've ever been given has pleased me more. The last word on honours, though, ought to be a joke. The painter, Francis Bacon, accepted nothing. He was asked in his 70s why he'd not taken a knighthood or the OM, and his reply, though camp, as so often with Bacon, concealed a good deal of common sense. Oh, I couldn't. So aging.